Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. When today's guest, Richard Walker, was on a couple of weeks ago to talk about his new book, Pictures of a Gone City, Tech and the Dark Side of Prosperity in the San Francisco Bay Area, we were inundated with emails and phone calls, so we decided to have him back. In his new book, Richard Walker lays out the history of the Bay Area, painting a portrait of the entire region. He shows how the glittering surface of Silicon Valley does not reflect the devastation facing low-income people, seniors, even middle-income people, and people of color. While a select group of people are benefiting from the area's prosperity, others grapple with a housing crisis, limited access to stable employment and health care, long commutes, the list goes on. Even people who work in technology, especially contractors, are struggling to make ends meet here. Richard Walker is Professor Emeritus of Geography at UC Berkeley. He's written a number of books about California. His latest is Pictures of a Gone City. And Richard Walker joins us in studio. Thank you for coming back.
Great to be back.
Great to have you. You know, I'm going to give out the phone number right away because we could not keep up with the calls and the emails last time around. So if you'd like to call in and talk about what we're facing here, you know, if you've lived here for a long time, what changes really strike you about what you've seen in the last 10 years? And how do you think we should tackle these issues? Housing, inequality, poverty, homelessness. In fact, today in San Francisco, a number of homeless moms and their children are having a Mother's Day rally at City Hall in San Francisco to call for housing and shelter. So this is where we're at. We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Head over to KALW's Facebook page, click on the video there, and leave a comment. Now, how long have you lived in the Bay Area?
Oh, my parents moved here when I was 10 months old.
So all of your life.
Yeah.
What strikes you the most about what you have seen, the major changes?
Oh, well, it's stunning how much bigger it is, how much denser it is. Of course, how the demographics have been transformed, but also life seemed. Now, I, of course, grew up in kind of sheltered suburbia, but, you know, life seemed easier, and it seems much harder now, as it does for most people in this country. Even here, despite being the most successful city in America for a couple, three generations, we have the highest average incomes. But it doesn't mean that everybody's doing great.
We just got word that California became the fifth largest economy in the world, surpassing the UK. It changes
a lot. Yeah, it's been kind of bouncing around that area for a long time. Back in the bubbles of the late 90s, the bubble of the mid 2000s, and now again, it's shot up to the top five, top six. Then in our recessions, we fall down to maybe number 10. But the fact is, California is a very big place, 40 million people, but also an incredible economic base, both north and south. And the result is that we are outproduce a lot of much larger countries. Mm. I mean, France, England have twice our population virtually, and or half again. And we have a larger gross domestic product.
You write that if you adjust the poverty level to reflect the cost of living here in California, it shoots up in the state close to about 20%.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And we have about a third of our workers are essentially below living wage. So you have a lot of people, working people, who are struggling to make ends meet. And we have a quarter of them are minimum wage. So even before you get down to the unemployed, the homeless, and the really desperate, you already have lots of people are struggling. There was an interesting study recently in Silicon Valley, I imagine you saw, that said about 20% of the people there deal with hunger on a regular basis. Mm. And that's kind of astounding. You think, well, maybe out in the Central Valley, maybe in the worst parts of, you know, agricultural farm worker communities where we expect that kind of poverty. But we have a lot of people here who are doing very low-end work, contracting through cheap labor contractors under lousy conditions. And that, you know, helps keep the whole thing going. So one of the things that everybody kind of forgets when they talk about a very high-end economy like the Bay Area, Silicon Valley, the Bay Area, is that every economy, no economy is purely high road, high end. Every economy requires a lot of cheap labor to keep going.
Mm. Speaking of hunger, I was at an event the other night and a professor from San Francisco State approached me and said, I listened to your radio show. Would you please do a segment about hungry students at San Francisco State? All of the professors bring Clif Bars to class because so many students come to class hungry.
I mean, this is just incredible. And it's something, you know, from when I was younger, you just couldn't imagine, you know, at San Francisco State. I mean, yeah, of course, it's been a place for working class kids and, you know, working middle class kids to move up and maybe get a degree, get into the professions and so on. That's much more harder. And B, they're starting from a much lower base in a number of ways. But to be hungry, and college kids, mm-hmm. I mean, we hear about it in elementary schools where it's epidemic. But at college, it's just astonishing. I mean, I'm just speechless. Which is rare, by the way, you probably noticed.
You spent a lot of time teaching at UC Berkeley. When you look at, you know, how we got here, we do a lot of shows about just what happened to unions, tax cuts, and how corporations used to provide more taxes than individuals, and that's completely flipped. Yeah. Now individuals spend more on taxes than corporations. We're seeing off-the-chart profits. I mean, we're seeing wealth that's just obscene. Like, some CEOs make like $20,000 to $40,000 an hour. They're making in an hour what their employees make in a year. When you look at the history, how do you explain it? What stands out for you the most? Because there are so many elements to this.
Well, it's interesting. Since we're at the 200th anniversary of the birth of Karl Marx, you know, and everybody dismisses what he said, he and Engels said about the impoverishment of the proletariat and all that. Oh, well, that didn't happen because we made great progress, and you see the workers have risen along with the capitalists. But since for the last 40 years now, with the end of the New Deal era, the social democratic era in Europe, and the New Deal era in the United States, we've returned to a system that you might say is more the norm of capitalism. We have to remember that in the Great Depression, capitalism just about collapsed. Franklin Roosevelt was elected, stepped in, and did a whole bunch with the rest of his team did a bunch of amazing programs that included things like Social Security and mortgage subsidies and food stamps, minimum wage, recognition of unions, and so on and so on. The result of that, combined with the fact that after the war, Europe was devastated, Japan, there were no competitors. America was on top of the world, not because we were so great, but because everybody else had been wrecked. So the combination was that you had a very prosperous country and a lot of the working class, ordinary people, could get a piece of the pie. Mm-hmm. And the right wing hated that. And they started plotting back in the 30s and kept plotting for years. But it was usually small numbers of them and so on who were plotting to get rid of that New Deal order. And you go back and look at comments by these extreme right-wing families like the Mercers and so on, the Reaganites, the Goldwaterites of the post-war era, and you'll see that their whole purpose was to turn that around. That was, in their view, unnatural, that the rich should anyways have to share with the workers and with the poor. So what they've been doing for 40 years is systematically cutting taxes, systematically breaking unions and keeping them out of the new sectors, and cutting programs that aid ordinary people. And that's what neoliberalism, as we lefties like to call it, or neoconservatism, whatever you want to call it. And California, to our great shame, was one of the major centers of this whole process, starting in the 1960s and 70s, really, and definitely taking off in the 80s. I saw George Duke Majan, our governor in the 80s, just died, and he oversaw this incredible shift from building highways and waterworks and so on to building our great public works in California in the 1980s and 90s were prisons. And we incarcerated more people per capita than any place on earth for a while. What Ruthie Gold, calls the Golden Gulag.
And now this LA Times piece is getting a lot of attention. California spends about $75,000 a year housing a prisoner, which is more than what it costs to go to Harvard, and spends about $10,000 per student.
Yeah, no, it's nuts. It's the priorities are so backwards. And of course, if you were spending money on kids and schools and family support and support for students in every regard, making sure they had a good diet, that they had good family support, their families, so they can go to school and succeed, you'd have a lot fewer people getting into trouble. And of course, we've defined trouble more and more in more draconian ways. There's now a pushback against the criminalization, but for 30 years, it was just worse and worse, so that working class boys of color, by and large, were almost sure to be caught in the net of the criminal justice system, and a huge proportion end up in prison instead of doing what they should have done, which would be employed, go to college, and become good citizens. But God forbid that be the purpose of treating ordinary people decently. That's apparently not what the elite want. There's very little evidence that they really care much about that, this sort of remarkable disdain of the rich for ordinary people. Well, you know, with some exceptions, they'll set up a philanthropic foundation like Bill Gates or Warren Buffett will say, yeah, there's a class war and my side's winning. But I don't see him necessarily doing anything about it.
To that point, what happens to a society when we rely more on philanthropy to deal with social issues than everyone paying in and government officials, community members, people who live in the community making these decisions?
Yeah, of course. I mean, instead of the money, first of all, going to working people, it goes to profits, and then it goes into the pockets of the very wealthy. And then, because in America we have this system of philanthropy, the rich turn around and set up a foundation, which gets them out of a lot of taxes and also allows them to steer where their so-called generosity goes. And it's interesting, and then we're all forced, you know, nonprofits, good causes, local governments, are forced to go cup in hand to the wealthy and say, oh, please help us do this, this, and this. You know, help our school, you know, beg, go have a cookie drive or something to raise money for your school. Well, if you're in Palo Alto or Rinda, you can do that with the parents. Mm-hmm. But if you're in Richmond, you can't. Or in most of Oakland, you can't. There isn't the money. When I was a kid, they just taxed the rich, taxed the corporations, and put it into the schools. And it's obscene that California fell from one of the top five in per capita school spending to one of the bottom five during this neoconservative era. And surprise, surprise, when I was young, most of the kids were white, and now most of the kids are brown and some other color, and they're getting the short end of the stick.
Today we're joined by Richard Walker, Professor Emeritus of Geography at UC Berkeley. He has written a number of books about California, and his latest is Pictures of a Gone City, Tech and the Dark Side of Prosperity in the San Francisco Bay Area. He writes about the entire region of the Bay Area, which has seen some of the most incredible wealth in the country and in many, even if you compare it to many parts of the world. Lots of wealth and some of the largest corporations that we interact with on a regular basis. He also shows how the glittering surface of Silicon Valley does not reflect the devastation facing low-income people, seniors, people of color, and now middle-income people who have a really hard time making it here. Many people say that they have no choice but to leave. If you'd like to chat about what you have seen, what changes you've seen, are you struggling to make ends meet? What are your thoughts about solutions to tackle these issues? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from Mark in San Francisco. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. So I find this to be kind of like a ruse, this discussion about that the rich are somehow responsible for the situation we have. So I'll speak specifically to San Francisco, where I've lived for 35 years. This city's budget is equal to the city and county of Los Angeles, equal to the city of Chicago. It is the second, sometimes fourth largest budget in the United States at $10, $11 billion. We spend $70,000 per homeless person. We spend $12,000 for educating their kids. And so if you look at San Francisco, it has enormous wealth, the government, unprecedented probably in the history of cities throughout the world. Yet, its policies, which are purely, really, a socialistic type of policy, have completely failed the working class people here. We're employing through the city and nonprofits probably in the range of around 30,000 people that are being paid minimum wage, but we have built zero housing for them. We have a population of 25 to 30,000 illegal immigrants, which supposedly would need housing too. What has the city done with its billions of dollars, numbers that just dwarf any other city in the world, other than maybe like Dubai, to deal with these things? What has it done for educating kids, giving them skills to be electricians? Because, you know, most of us are working class people who live in the city. It's the skills that you have. What has the city done in trade schools or providing opportunities for people to get ahead? It tried to, even when the voters approved to give free education or to, you know, to do the final subsidizing of city college, the supervisors tried to take that away and not give anything, even though the voters were approving $50 million to give to city college. It ended up compromising, really, because of Mayor Lee refusing to go along with the supervisors to give them $5 million, even though the tax that the voters approved was $50 million for the city. So I think, you know, trying to dump this upon a few successful people that are making a lot of money and not deal with the city government or the government.
All right, Mark, let me get a response from Richard Walker. Thanks for calling.
Well, Mark, you brought up a lot of good points, and I think one of the problems with what you're saying is that we tend to look at the wrong scale. And you're looking at the city of San Francisco and saying, wow, it's so rich. Yeah, right now it has a lot of taxes coming in from the successful business, very prosperous place. We are, as I've said in my book, one of the most prosperous places on earth right now. So it's not surprising that the money flows into the coffers at this time. But a lot of policies you're talking about, like take schools. Most school funding is not based at the city level. It's at the state level, amplified by federal grants and so on. You said build housing. Well, the city doesn't really build housing. And when we did build public housing, it was with massive federal grants, which have all disappeared. So, like, you can't say, well, San Francisco isn't building freeways. Well, it never did build freeways. Somebody else did that. Now, that doesn't mean that the city of San Francisco's policies are always great by any means. On one thing, you know, Ed Lee is very, very friendly to the developers. A lot of pro-development policy, but as you say, starving San Francisco City College, which is not a good policy. I don't agree with that at all. Skills and trade schools. There you're talking about shifts in education policy. Again, I think that's something that it generally is much larger, even though, of course, San Francisco has a role to play. But again and again, people in San Francisco are so focused on San Francisco, and I try in my book to say, look, could you look at the whole region at least? Because we either go from obsession with our city politics, it's the same over in Berkeley where I live, or to the national politics. And we tend not to look in between. We don't take California that seriously. We don't take our metropolitan region that seriously. And yet lots of decisions and key policies are made, key developments happen at those scales. I mean, I may sound very wonky because I'm a geographer, but I do think we miss the point, and we miss the target of what we're worried about, and whether it's inequality or it's housing policy or it's school policy, we have to be careful to look at the right scale.
What about his comment about housing? Because we often hear that the state has really failed when it comes to building housing. In fact, Senator Scott Wiener has said this many, many times. There's a reason we don't build much housing, and it's been that way for 50 years, talking about SB 827. Fernando Marti, co-director of the Council of Community Housing Organizations, looked at census data for the Bay Area going back to 1950 and found that construction was booming 40 years ago, 50 years ago, and 10 years ago. He says that units were being produced at a much faster rate than population growth throughout the 50s, 60s, 70s, and again in the 2000s until 2008. And his comments were over at 48hills.org. Can you tell us about this? Because you often hear this, that this state has just failed. We're just not building enough housing.
Yeah. Well, I look at two sides of that. On the one hand, yeah, obviously we're not building as much housing as we need. But a lot of that is due to the fact that the boom is so intense here that you can't possibly catch up. So the first thing people need to realize is that it's not a shortage of supply in the short run. You're dealing with three or four things. One is very rapid economic growth, which brings in lots of people, lots of money, and so on, shoots up very fast. And suddenly people have money to bid for rentals and outbid the people who used to be there, and landlords then turn over the property. And bingo, you've changed the makeup of who are your renters. Secondly, you have immense growth of wealth. And Mark didn't want to blame the people at the top, but the fact is we have more billionaires per square inch and millionaires per square inch than any city in America and maybe on Earth. And those people do bear responsibility in a sense, not that, oh, they shouldn't be successful. That's fine. I don't mind that. But you don't necessarily need to be a multi-billionaire to enjoy your success. Maybe you could just be a multi-millionaire, and that would suffice. So that money, there's a lot of surplus produced by the tech economy, by the Bay Area economy, that could well be diverted into the kind of policies you want, whether it's housing or schooling, whatever it happens to be, that is being left in the pockets of the very rich, and then we go begging, hoping that they'll give us some money back. Finally, of course, inequality has grown, so you have wages have not gone up. We have supposedly the longest growth boom in recent history since 2008, but it started from the gutter. It started from an incredible pit. It's actually been the worst recovery in at least as far as the data go back to the 1930s from any recession. And the result, there were huge numbers of unemployed people, and people then left the labor force. And the result is that labor markets are just tightening up now. And when we say, well, it's very low unemployment, yeah, but a lot of people weren't even in the labor market, weren't even counted. Now they come back in. But wages haven't really gone up. Mm. And so you have people who cannot pay for a much more expensive city at this time. So that's the plight we have. And supply, we can talk then about housing supply and where it comes from and so on. But California doesn't build housing. Developers build housing. All local governments usually control and oversee the building of housing and commercial development, skyscrapers, whatever it is. They oversee development by private entities. Public housing disappeared long ago in this country, virtually, so we don't do that. And that was federal money, not state money, too. So what California is, of course, could have done more if we had more money, if we had the will to build more public housing. But that's not on the local governments, really, except where you have some cases of local governments, particularly the local enclaves, like rich enclaves like Palo Alto and Arinda and Lafayette and Marin County, that really don't allow enough multiple housing, apartment buildings, so on, to accommodate more people.
According to the mayor's office in San Francisco, 1,400 units of affordable housing are scheduled to begin construction this year. Today, we're joined by Richard Walker, professor emeritus of geography at UC Berkeley, author of the book Pictures of a Gone City, Tech and the Dark Side of Prosperity in the San Francisco Bay Area. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
I'm Matt Martin here with Laura Wenis, producer of Your Call, taking a moment in this conversation between Rose and Richard Walker to ask for your support for local public radio. We've had an amazing day so far, and we ask you to keep the momentum strong by making a call to 800-525-9917, or you can go to KALW.org where you can see Pictures of a Gone City, Richard Walker's new book, which we have as our thanks to you for a gift of $120 to KALW.
You know, part of having programming like this that's so connected to the listeners is that we listen to you. We brought Richard Walker back because we know people really want to hear from him. And we want to hear from you if you want to support that kind of work. Go to KALW.org or call 800-525-9917 to show your support for radio that listens to you.
800-525-9917, KALW.org. The issues that Richard Walker is addressing in this book, these are nationwide issues about housing and inequality. But right here in the Bay Area, we are, you know, we're in the furnace of this, right? So we're living it together. We need to have a conversation about it together. We need real information that lets us have a constructive response. That's what you support when you call 800-525-9917 or go to KALW.org.
Indeed. You know, you say furnace. This is the kind of issue that we call a hot button issue. This place is a crucible. But Your Call is a program, is a show where you can have real, thoughtful, in-depth, informed conversations about those hot button issues. This is the kind of programming that you support when you go to KALW.org, call 800-525-9917 to keep it on the air.
800-525-9917. Support Rose Aguilar's engaged conversations with activists, with academics, with regular people who are dealing with these issues. Your support keeps that conversation strong. We thank you for being part of KALW.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are joined by Richard Walker, Professor Emeritus of Geography at UC Berkeley. He is the author of a number of books about California, the history of our state. His latest is Pictures of a Gone City, Tech and the Dark Side of Prosperity in the San Francisco Bay Area. Richard Walker was on a couple weeks ago, and we had so many phone calls, and so we decided to bring him back because these issues are pressing. They're now getting international attention when we're talking about inequality, poverty, our housing crisis, education crisis. If you have any questions or comments for Richard Walker, if you'd like to talk about what has changed for you in the Bay Area over the past couple of decades, and what changes would you like to see? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall at kalw.org. Join us on Facebook at the KALW Facebook page. Click on the video and then leave a comment there. The last time you were on, a number has stuck with me. You said that if every taxpayer paid $66 a year in California, once again, we could provide free public colleges and universities.
That's right. That's a number developed by the coalition of faculty associations at UC. There's five on five of the campuses. And it's based on good, solid research about what it would take. We could go back to free tuition. It does show you how kind of pathetic the lack of public services, public goods are in the present time, that the neoliberals, the conservatives, have been so successful at making it sound like, oh, this stuff's going to bankrupt us. It's going to bankrupt us if we provide good education for our kids, if we provide free meals. And it's just rubbish because we give away so much money in tax breaks. I mean, the Republicans have had four major tax cuts since the 1980s. that have allowed the rich to get much, much richer, even though they were doing fine in the post-war era. The economy was doing fine. But now the economy is not doing that great. The people are not doing that great. But the upper class are doing very, very well. So, you know, it's kind of absurd that we can't do better. We did it. I mean, the Roosevelt administration, the New Deal in the 1930s, and the worst time in American history, when nobody believed in deficit budgets, nobody believed in even have the federal government playing a role in things like employment and Social Security, they did it. They made it happen in the worst of times, and it underwrote this great period of prosperity after World War II for the next 20, 30 years. But the right always hated it and always wanted to cut it back because it was unnatural. And I think, unfortunately, what we're seeing is capitalism in its natural state really produces massive inequality. It may produce tremendous wealth, tremendous prosperity, technological wonders. It does all those things. And, you know, if you go back, as I said earlier, it's the 200th anniversary of the birth of Karl Marx. But if you go back and read the Communist Manifesto, he and Engels said, you know, the bourgeoisie produced more wonders. The capitalists, the business class, whatever you want to call them, produced more wonders in 100 years than all previous civilizations, and that's true. But what's going on? What's the underside of that? And I think we here in the Bay Area, it's interesting, we tend to think of the problems of the world as somewhere else. It's Trump in Washington. It's those gun-loving nuts in Florida or whatever it may be. But the problems and the contradictions are right under our nose here. Even we are the most successful place on earth practically, but we have to look at how many problems we still have in terms of inequality, people not being able to live here, not being able to survive, going hungry, getting a bad education. That's kind of pathetic given how well off we are.
Right. And the national media often write about California as being the state of resistance because politicians in Sacramento take on Trump. What strikes you about the Democratic Party in this state and how it has changed over the years?
Yeah. Well, it's a very mixed bag. First of all, as I said earlier, we were a key area of the Republican and neoconservative, neoliberal revenge against the New Deal in the late 20th century. It started to turn around 2000. The reason it turned around is not that we got more enlightened or we intellectuals at the university suddenly got smarter. It's basically because we had more immigrants and their children voting. And the new working families, working class, whatever you want to call them in California, are most, you know, around two-thirds people of color. And they've come in as immigrants, as has happened throughout American history. They want a better life. They want a better life for their kids. They want better education. They want health care. They want all those kind of basic services for ordinary people. And they vote for it, and that makes California into the bluest of the blue states. But we have a lot of things we can't really celebrate. And I think a lot of our older Democrats, very mixed bag. The Democratic Party, since Bill Clinton was president, has been very neoliberal. That is, pro-market, pro-business, with a little bit of social sharing. You know, they're kind of the free market with the human face or something like that. And that isn't really what we need. We need something much more dramatic. We are seeing a kind of urban revolution here that's undercutting the well-being of millions of people in Bay Area and in California, and we need something more radical.
Today we're joined by Richard Walker, author of Pictures of a Gone City, Tech and the Dark Side of Prosperity in the San Francisco Bay Area. Let's hear from Roberta in San Francisco. Hi, Roberta. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you. This is a great show. So I had a thought about...
Roberta, can you turn your radio down?
Yes. I had a thought...
Thank you.
...about linking corporate tax cuts to their employing people regionally at their livable wage. So, example, in the San Francisco Bay Area, if corporations were required to hire people at the $125,000 it takes to... So the more people they hire at that and above, the better tax credit they get. It would also force them to pay people's medical, dental, all those benefits and 401ks. It would lift the entire area, and it would reduce the CEO's ability to be paid so much. But if you did that across the U.S., my belief is that more companies would look at it as that's the carrot and stick. They would have to hire people at the livable wage of that region in order to get their tax credits, and that would reduce the amount of profit, yet it would raise everybody up. And I don't know, you know, it may help, but I just think that makes more sense than just giving away billions of dollars to people who don't really need it.
Well, Roberta, I wish you were president. That's an extremely radical proposal, let me assure you. The corporations don't want to pay living wage to everybody. It's a huge struggle, you know, the fight for 15 to try and get fast food workers, restaurant workers here and across the country to get a kind of living minimum wage. I mean, fight for $15 an hour is not really a living wage in the Bay Area. Living wage is much higher, maybe double or triple that. But it's the point you're making is absolutely right, that what you need to do is raise the wages of ordinary workers and the benefits. We all need the benefits. I mean, we all need a decent pension fund building up. We all need health care. These are just basics. These are the essentials of modern living. It's kind of unbelievable that we don't have it. And America is so far behind other countries and has been for a long time. You know, we are just—we so love the free market, every man and woman for himself, herself. And if you fall through the cracks, well, too bad, that's your problem. And that's really not the way it is. It's a social process. People are develop as social beings, and we need to have social security and social safety nets and so on. So I think what you see is going on in the Bay Area is that actually unions and organizers like— down in Silicon Valley, and a lot of the unions, you know, like Teamsters and United Food Works and so on, are organizing people who are working as food preparers, as cleaners, as gardeners, as truckers, the guys driving the buses, you know, the famous Silicon Valley buses driving through San Francisco. Those people are now unionized. Mm-hmm. And that's a way to get the wage up. I wish you could just declare it, pass a law and say everybody has to get a living wage. You could do that. But barring that, it's a battle, you know, workplace by workplace.
Well, thank you for calling in, Roberta. AJ on Twitter says, rich speculators are buying up housing and holding it. If we build more housing, they're going to do the same. So to just build our way out of a crisis could be a disaster.
Yeah, AJ is right. You can't build your way out of this housing crisis. First of all, you can't do it fast enough. Building takes a long time. Even if you sort of are wide open and don't have much restrictions on the developers, it takes a long time to build housing. It's hard. You got to get the property. And within cities, you're restructuring the city. You have to get the land. You have to get your architect to design it. You have to get all the permits. You have to get your financing. You have to organize. You know, your contractors have to be on board. It takes a long time. And in a boom, everybody's fighting for the same contractors, for example, and you can't get a contractor. And people who do home improvements in a boom are familiar with that, but the same thing applies to the big corporate developers. So you can't build it fast enough. Secondly, what developers are going to do in a very unequal market is they want to build for the upper classes. Why would they build for moderate or low-income housing? It's much less profitable. So that has to be forced on developers. Otherwise, they're not going to do it. If you had a more equal distribution, as you did after World War II, where you had more unionized workers and much higher tax rates on corporations, individuals, and so on, then you saw a lot of developers producing small houses for working people. And we don't get that now because of the inequality. And the speculators, to speculators now. Yes, in a market that's extremely squeezed with this incredible bottlenecks, the speculators get in there, and there's a lot of outside money coming in, buying through REITs, Real Estate Investment Trusts, and other means, LLCs. They come in. They're often anonymous money. It's like Sean Hannity buying up foreclosed houses. But the same thing happens here. There's a lot of money coming from outside into the Bay Area because this is such a robust economy. A lot of investors elsewhere looking for returns are investing here. Well, one of the things you can do is invest in a big apartment building, flip it, get in higher income people to pay a higher rent. And even if you can't flip it immediately, it takes time, you're willing to wait because you have a lot of money, you've got time, and prices are only going up.
Well, thank you for the call. I just found a piece at CalMatters called Big Investment Firms Have Stopped Gobbling Up California Homes. They gobbled them up after the 2008 crisis, and it looks like it's slowed down. So I'll put that story on our website after the show. You know, the other thing, a couple years ago, I met someone who deals with the finances when someone buys one of these luxury condos. And she said that in some cases, almost the entire floor would be empty. And so the one person who would live on that floor said, "Can you move me somewhere where I actually have neighbors? Because nobody lives here."
No, and I've heard stories where they will slowly go through apartment by apartment, redoing the apartment, and the noise and the dust is so intolerable that if you're a tenant, you move out. And that's how they get you out. They just make it unlivable. So, yeah, they're not buying up individual houses. That was after the foreclosure crisis.
Right.
I mean, the thing is, capital always wins. I mean, this is, I don't know why we don't see that more clearly. First of all, they pumped up the mortgage investments. They suckered people into buying mortgages or getting, you know, mortgage loans that they couldn't afford. Then when the system collapsed in the crisis of 2007, 2008, people lost their homes. What happened? Well, instead of the federal government coming in massively under Obama, they could have come in and supported and bailed those people out. They bailed the banks out. That left the homes empty, boarded up. Banks wanted to get rid of them because banks aren't really property owners. So you had a whole set of property owners. These investors come in and snap up the houses. Some of the worst ones, like the guy who created Nationwide Bank, which was the worst of the mortgage lenders. It went under in the crisis. Then he set up another company. And Steve Mnuchin, who's our Treasury Secretary, also did this, set up these fronts for their investor buddies, and they go in and buy all the foreclosed houses. But now the hot market is the rental market because nobody can afford a house. So that's where the big money's going into big apartment houses they can flip.
Thank you for calling in, Roberta. Richard Walker is author of Pictures of a Gone City, Tech and the Dark Side of Prosperity in the San Francisco Bay Area. Let's go next to Mark in Berkeley. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me on. 40 years ago, we had a lot of success in getting the buildings and the properties away from the landlords through a strong, organized co-op movement. A co-op, they seem to have gone by the wayside. But the more successful ones who had good internal process and the skills, it does require skills to pull this off. And these days, the banks have shown more of a willingness to provide funding for groups, which was very hard in the old days. So I'm just wondering if a possible revival of groups of people coming together to take over some of these properties, including like the old warehouses, you know, where the artists live in residences and all those kind of things. I'll take my answer on the air. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Mark, I think you're pointing to something that would be very, very helpful, which you need to get more housing out of the everyday market. Because when you're in the everyday market, housing is subject to these great swings in valuation. People can't pay, and then they're forced out. So if you want to have a more stable housing supply, you need to intervene in ways that control that market and control demand. One of the ways, of course, is rent control, which we got good rent control in Berkeley and San Francisco to a degree, in Santa Monica, and then the landlords passed a state law to get rid of rent control. which is Costa-Hawkins, and there's now a movement to get rid of that, which everyone should support. We need local rent control, eviction control, condo conversion control, and so on to help keep to stabilize, slow down this runaway train of the housing market. Now, in the longer term, that's short term. In the longer term, you want to create more housing, and you also want to create more housing that is stable. And co-ops are a good way to do that. Co-op banking to support those kind of co-ops. They're not always easy to manage, and you need, as you said, Mark, you need very good management. This is not simple. It's not like, oh, we're just going to like all have a giant human being. That didn't work out so well. You got to be businesslike and manage these things. But you can manage them. You can take them out of the ordinary market and have collective ownership. You can also do things like land trusts. You know, if you look at the environmental movement around the Bay Area, it has used land trusts brilliantly, where you get out ahead of the market in recessions especially, buy up land, maybe rich people give you a big donation, and then you can buy up the land through a land trust and then turn it over to a park or an open space district. So, well, we could do the same thing with housing. In the central city, it's very hard, but we really haven't tried, and it's something we should be doing over the long run.
Thank you for the phone call. Richard, we have about 3 minutes left, and Greg in San Francisco says, the inequality is a failure of democracy. How can voter involvement shift things? And I think it's important to always remember that 100 million people did not vote. More people during the presidential election did not vote than people who did vote. And when you look at polling around things like repealing Citizens United, increasing the minimum wage, tackling climate change, funding education, the majority of the people want these things. That's what the polling shows. But the politicians do the exact opposite.
Yeah, you know, you really need to have confidence in people. We tend to be quick to denounce, oh, well, you know, people are so, you know, ignorant or dumb, they vote for Trump and so on. I think you actually have to have confidence in the ordinary people in voting. And the fact is, if you take polls on almost every topic, you can take a poll across the U.S., and we sort of Bay Area progressives, we go, yeah, I agree with that. And the problem is, of course, there is a ruling elite, and they have the power and the money. The only counterpowers we have are our democratic voting, our citizenship, getting organized through unions and other associations, and fighting. And we have to fight like hell to get our democracy back. The state of American democracy is pretty deteriorated over the last 50 years, and the elites like it that way. So something like inequality is the symptom of the disease. The disease is actually the undermining of American democracy.
Hmm. There was a great Business Insider poll given to Republicans, and they said, would you rather have the Democratic progressive budget, the Democratic budget, or the right-wing Republican budget? And they didn't label them. And the Republicans chose the Democratic progressive budget.
Yes. Well, I think ordinary, there are a lot of confused other, they're confounded people. They're unhappy. Things are not right. Mm-hmm. They're suffering in, you know, all the places that aren't a success in America, all the places that have gone downhill. They look at their communities, they look at their kids, and they say, this is a mess. Mm-hmm. But they don't know what to do. Yeah. And they've been made systematically ignorant by Fox News and a lot of other outlets over time, and they lash out by voting for Trump. And we're in a very serious situation.
Richard Walker is Professor Emeritus of Geography at UC Berkeley. He's written a number of books about California. His latest is Pictures of a Gone City, Tech and the Dark Side of Prosperity in the San Francisco Bay Area. Richard, thank you again for coming in, and thank you for your work.
My pleasure. Thank you for your show.
Thank you. Thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. This is Your Call.